With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin, and in each episode I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a difficult breakup. Games, a bit like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, for My Perfect Console. My guest today is a British-Malaysian stand-up comedian and comedy writer. Born in the UK when he was 1 week old, his parents moved to Malaysia, where he attended school until the age of 16. The family then returned to England, moving to Bath in Somerset, which my guest once described as a spa town for people who find Cheltenham too ethnic. While studying engineering at King's College Cambridge, he joined the Footlights Drama Club, of which he later became president. And since graduating, he has performed with the sketch comedy group Daphne and become a fixture on British televisions, appearing on Have I Got News For You, 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown, and as a contestant on the 7th season of Taskmaster. He also co-hosts the podcast Bud Pod with his friend and fellow comedian Pierre Novelli, where, among many other things, the pair often discuss video games. Welcome, Phil Wang.
Hi, Simon. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, man.
Thanks, Phil.
I'm looking forward to talking to you.
Yeah, me too.
I left the UK when I was 3 weeks old, I found out.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, because I used to think it was 1 week, and then my parents told me it's 3 weeks.
Yeah. And you were born in the same hospital as Robbie Williams, is that right?
Yes, I'm pretty sure that's right. North Staffordshire Maternity Hospital. A hospital of greatness.
Nice. Well, I recently heard you say that this year, 2023, is the year in which you're trying to say yes to everything.
Yes.
Which is good for me, asking you to come on this show. But I wondered how that was going. Do you find you've already taken on too much?
No, not really. It turns out when you say no to people for a year, they stop asking you to do things. But no, it's been going all right. Yeah, just trying to. I've already hit a couple of hurdles, and I was talking to Pierre, who I do Bud Pod with, and yesterday we sort of both revealed to each other that we have the same problem with life, which is that our favorite thing in the world is downtime.
Right.
And my whole life, every effort I've put into life has been in order to, at some point in the future, secure downtime.
Right, okay, yeah.
Do homework, finish homework now, later you have downtime, right? Do well now, work hard now, later on you'll get rewarded with the downtime. So once I have downtime, it's very, very hard for me to say yes to something that'll take me out of the downtime, which I think also feeds into the whole gamer thing, because I think that's what being a gamer teaches you, is that the best thing in the world is downtime,
right?
Because you can play games.
Did you enjoy the lockdowns, sort of 18 months of downtime?
I mean, at first, yeah, I was with my sister in a flat in London, and I got to play some games, which I did like. It felt like I was able to catch up on them, because in recent years, I've had less and less time to play games, which was never the plan. The whole point of me sort of pursuing this career was that I would have time for games, but it got a bit busy for that. But then lockdown offered an opportunity to play more games, and I don't know if it was by chance, but the lockdown seemed to coincide with the release of like very big budget post-apocalyptic games. And so it was actually quite hard to escape the sense of global doom, because I was playing Death Stranding and The Last of Us 2.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't think this is helping.
Death Stranding is literally about basically an Amazon delivery man as well, isn't it?
That's true. Yeah, that's true. I was able to greet the delivery drivers with a great deal of respect after playing Death Stranding.
Increased your empathy.
I feel like we were brothers in arms. Yeah.
I was wondering as well, you know, with your thing this year of saying yes to people, does that reflect the kind of player you are in games where... Particularly, I suppose, like in adventure games, NPCs are always trying to get you to do little missions, distract you from like the main quest.
Yeah.
Are you the kind of player who sort of needs to clear up every side quest before you move on? Or do you just focus on the main thing?
Oh, no, I'm very much a side quest kind of person. I'm not always like 100%er, like getting all the hidden packages and stuff. I'm like, let's be realistic. That's not going to happen. But with regards to side quests and side missions, I always make sure to get the most of it. I think part of it is like, I feel I have to get the most value out of this game I've bought and enjoy the most content out of it, you know? And so I love, one of my favorite features of recent games is when you're about to progress in the story and a message comes up that goes, this is your last chance to get little jobs done. Are they trying to come up with some code to say this is your last chance to do side missions?
Yeah.
Make sure you've wrapped everything up before you enter this building. And I go, okay, great, thanks. And then I go wrap everything up. So I'm very much a completist with regards to the missions, side missions.
Yeah, you're saying yes to all the computer characters as well as the podcasters.
Yeah, I'll take a package to your cousin at the next town, even though I'm a level 80 for a sorcerer or whatever, and this is far beneath me.
And the world's about to end as well. But yeah, sure, I'll deliver your package, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, yeah, I was wondering if you could tell me as well, when did sort of video games first enter your life? Your youngest years are spent in Malaysia. Did you have a computer or a games console at that time? When did that all start for you?
Yeah, so the first games I played would have been on the Windows 95, I think. So I remember vividly being a kid and I saw someone use a computer. Oh, I'd heard about these computers that were becoming like home computers. You could have them at home. And I said to my father, Dad, I'd like a computer. And my father, much to his credit, was always very keen on his children sort of becoming sort of masters of the future. You know, he really had an eye for the future, and he knew, he had that feeling that computers were going to be important and then those kids should be good at them. He even signed us up to, I remember this the other day, he signed us up to a little sort of after school class club thing called Future Kids.
Nice.
And it was it just taught kids how to use computers. It was like a little tuition center for children to learn how to use computers, and he wanted his son to be a future kid, a kid of the future,
right?
And so I'd turn up after school once a week and I'd be taught how to use PowerPoint and Excel and Word and stuff like that. So my father was very much like, okay, if you want a computer, you should get a computer, figure out the way. I think he did not foresee that I would use them mostly to play Minesweeper and Ski Free.
Right, right.
And I think a couple of years down the line, he became quite regretful, because all I wanted to do was stay at home and play computer games. And I think maybe he felt like, well, maybe he'd taken a wrong turn.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, that brings us neatly to your first choice. So in the premise of the podcast, I'm asking you to pick the five video games you want to put on your fictional ideal games machine, and I think you've mentioned your first choice there. Can you tell us about it? What was the game and what did you do in it and why did you love it?
So this is the first game I can ever remember playing, and it's Ski Free. I was never able to figure out if the free and ski free was sort of an allusion to you being free to ski down the slopes, or that came free with Windows 95. I'm not sure which element they were referring to, but I was just sort of mesmerized by it because, like, graphically, I think it's still quite beautiful. It's a very economical use of the processing power available at the time, because it's just white pixels and they put little trees and it makes it look like a piste, and you were just in control of a tiny 8-bit ski character, and you could move around sort of with the directional keys, and once you got started down the slope you just try and get between ski between the markers and avoid the trees. You could tell the different of textures of snow, because some bits of snow were dottier, some bits were smooth, and you could really pick up speed, and it was thrilling to watch those trees whiz by, and it had a real sense of motion to it, with using very little, really, graphically speaking, it had very little to play with, but it really gave you a sense of like movement and speed and momentum. Like the screen, as it were, would move with your figure, and you would slow down and speed up with a real sense of inertia. You could feel when you got stuck in a little bit of bumpy snow, and you could feel when you were really hurtling down a smooth bit of piste. And so it really did have a sense of physicality to it, I thought.
Yeah. It's funny, those early games were often either set in space, because then most of the screen could just be black, couldn't it? Black screen didn't need to be drawn in, or they would be set like on a snowy, because then it could all be white. And I guess that's what they were doing, sort of saving on memory.
Yeah.
Just by having a mainly white background here. So was it a game that you really played every day in an effort to beat your score and all of that stuff, or is it just something you dipped into? What was it? What kind of player were you of the game?
I was sort of too young to really understand the point of these games, or I hadn't yet developed that sort of more grown-up pursuit of scores or goals. What was fascinating to me was just the mechanisms of it and the graphics of it, and the fact that it existed at all. This thing existed on the computer for the mere purpose of sort of being fun and exciting. I don't even remember I guess the point was to get as far down as you could, but I would just dip in, I'd go home, get home from school, and I just fiddle with it and just sort of enjoy the movements of it, enjoy the thrill of it. And the thing about those early games was there's a real sense of mystery as to why you were doing it. Like, why are you hurtling down this ski slope? Why are you, how is this mine sweeping exactly? And how are you meant to tell where the mines are? And why are some squares worth more than other squares? But it didn't really matter. It just sort of existed. And you took for granted that, it existed for a purpose. And with the main mystery of Ski Free that I still to this day do not understand is the Yeti, which is still the most frightening character in video games to me. It's a Ski Free Yeti who would, at random points, just run out of the forest and grab you and eat you. It was terrifying. And I didn't really understand what triggered the Yeti. I didn't understand if it was possible to escape the Yeti. It didn't seem very possible. And there was just a great sense of unfairness about the Yeti, because I was like, well, how am I supposed to beat this guy? I'm just a humble skier. I'm trying to ski free here.
Yeah.
And to this day, I don't understand if you're able to beat the Yeti.
Yeah, I don't know. We'd have to have a check on game FAQs or something. How do you beat the Yeti?
Yeah, but for me, Ski Free, it still represents a very sort of magical moment when something I didn't realize was possible became possible,
Yeah. Yeah, I wonder why they put that in. I guess it's that thing of designers thinking, well, we need some sort of conflict element. But as you say, there were, it's not like there were long cinematic bits of storyline before you played these games. So it was all just, quite dreamlike, wasn't it? I suppose you might say.
Yeah, it felt like the skier and the Yeti had history or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, did this skier sleep with the Yeti's wife or something? What happened? Why does the Yeti hate the skier so much? And why hasn't the park done anything about this? Why hasn't the skiing company, who are surely aware there's a Yeti stalking and eating their customers, they've not done anything about it. Yeah. To this day, I'm scared of the Yeti. What's also interesting, it's the way you remember these things as being more vivid than they actually are. Like I go back, I've looked at pictures of Ski Free since, and I'm like, wow, there's actually very little detail. But what I remember is the Yeti's like got full facial features, claws, you know, details on the torso. And it's amazing what the mind will, what the gaps the mind will sort of cross in memory. And sort of, and the graphics have got better and better and better, but our experience of them maybe necessarily hasn't. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's that weird thing. It's a bit like reading a novel, isn't it? Where you just sort of fill in all the gaps in your imagination. And so when you recall it years later, it's got this fidelity that it never had, I suppose.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Very strange.
Yeah.
So what kind of kid were you at school in Malaysia?
I was very studious. I was quite shy and quite afraid of things. I guess you could say I was a bit nerdy. I was good at school. I liked maths, and that I found the social aspect of school much more difficult than the schoolwork itself. And yeah, I was nervous. I was quite a nervous kid, really, and a serious student. Yeah, like I alluded to earlier, you know, I did my work so that I could have free time later on.
Yeah,
I was quite a sensitive kid. You know, I was into sort of writing poems or little poems, and I liked music and...
Oh, nice. You had the arts and the sciences.
Yeah, I guess in a way. I mean, they were very bad poems,
right?
Don't get me wrong. They're terrible. I guess if I had to summarize my child self, I was quite a sensitive, quite nervous kid, but good at maths.
Yeah. And did you have a little group of nerdy friends who also liked video games, or was it not like that?
Well, interestingly, in Malaysia, like, video games and nerdiness were not really associated with each other. And something I've noticed, and I've also certainly noticed listening to your podcast, is that I think there is a real... I've noticed there's a real correlation between people who grew up in boring places and how much they love video games. I think growing up in a boring place makes you really, really love and appreciate video games. And where I grew up not just in Malaysia, but in East Malaysia, North Borneo, you know, so it was very remote. There was not very much going on at all. And so when video games came about, the boys especially, just there was nothing else to do, so you got into video games. And so it wasn't really considered like a nerdy thing. It was more like, well, what else is there to do? This is more exciting than anything else we have available to us, so why wouldn't you play this? And so it wasn't really until later on in life that the idea of video games being a nerdy pursuit became apparent to me. And so yeah, I definitely had friends who were into video games and played video games. Counter-Strike was the big one that got boys together, as
right,
it were.
Right, yeah.
Because we didn't have internet that was good enough to play at home online, but we had internet cafes. And in East Asia, I'm sure you're aware of this, you know, there's this real culture of going to, maybe not so much anymore, but you'd go to an internet cafe and you'd get your computers and you'd all play Counter-Strike together, the original Counter-Strike. And it was sort of talked about almost in the same tones as a jock would talk about sports. You know, you'd, one kid would be very good at Counter-Strike and they'd be very well respected. And you try and get better at Counter-Strike and you try and, you know, share tips about how to be better at Counter-Strike. And guys would sort of arrange outings to go to the internet cafe and you play Counter-Strike.
Where were you in the pecking order of your friends?
I think not particularly high, because I was never really into multiplayer. And this, so even for a gamer, I'm lonely. I've always liked video games for the private experience. I still don't really play multiplayer. I don't like multiplayer. I like video games with the story and that get you very involved. I always from the get-go saw it as the most engrossing form of storytelling and world building that we've sort of come up with as a civilization is video games. And so from the very beginning, I was into the stories and the escapism. But it was still very cool the first time you got to play Counter-Strike and go, oh, that's my friend Ranky, and he's in charge of that guy, and that's him running around. And when he moves on the keyboard, he moves around my screen. That's amazing.
Was he the king jock, Ranky?
No, not at all. No, no, no. He was the funniest guy. He was the funniest person.
Cool, yeah.
Yeah, he was a class clown. But yeah, so games were very much in Malaysia not considered like a nerdy pursuit. Probably the ones I was playing could be a bit nerdier, but no, it wasn't really until I came to the UK that I became aware of games as a bit dorky and nerdy.
And you're a mixed race household, so your mum is white British, is that right? And she's an archaeologist, and your father is Malaysian.
Yes, she's a doctor now, but when they met, she was an archaeologist in Malaysia, and that's why she went out to do archaeology. And my father's an engineer, and he when my mother went to Malaysia she decided to take up martial arts lessons to learn some self-defense. And she turned up and my father was her kung fu instructor. And that's how they met. Yeah.
So it's amazing.
It's a real... I mean, if you wrote this meet cute as a sort of East meets West love story, I think...
Yeah, it'd be torn up.
I think the editors would be like, come on, that's a, it's a bit much. It's a bit on the nose.
Yeah,
but,
right.
But it's literally what happened.
And you published a book about this a couple of years ago called Side Splitter, How to Be From Two Worlds at Once, which is excellent. Everyone should go out and get it and read it. But I was wondering, you know, could you tell us what was it like, you know, having parents from two very different cultures? Did one culture dominate in your household or was it pretty even split?
Oh, yeah, of course. That's a tough question, really. I mean, I suppose the British side was hard to escape, especially the English speaking. I mean, we grew up with English as our first language, really. And so that dominated. I mean, culturally speaking, I suppose the Western stuff dominated because also the TV and films we got were Western, were British or American. And Malaysia being an ex-British colony, there were sort of leftover British influences.
Right.
But sort of food-wise, we were very Asian, very Malaysian. In terms of like... importance on education and doing well at school, very Malaysian. Similar to the video games thing, you know, the idea of it being nerdy and lame to be good at school is very Western. In Malaysia, it's very common for like the cool kids to be cool because they were good at school. So I definitely internalized that side of East Asian culture. But I think in terms of like film and movies and literature, yeah, Western, very much Western. And video games as well, Western. I always veered more to the Western games than the Japanese games, which seem to be the main divide. You know, there's the Western stuff and the Japanese stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I always veered more towards the Western stuff.
When you moved back to the UK, did it feel perhaps like less of a culture shock because you'd sort of grown up on Western TV, do you think? Or was it still very different?
It was more of a shock than I... expected it to be. I thought that I was very well prepared. You know, that I was half British. My mum was British. I felt, because I grew up feeling out of place in Malaysia because I was kind of the white kid. Mm. I thought, well, logically speaking, this must mean that when I move to the UK, I'll be accepted and I'll fit in. And then I moved to the UK and suddenly I was the Asian kid.
Right.
And I realized, oh gosh, this, you know, this is, I think this is just going to be how it is forever.
Yeah, right.
Well, not only did I move to England, but I moved to Bath in England, which is like, you know, it's a very particular type of England, cutesy England, a very Jane Austen England.
Yeah.
And so it was really into the deep end.
Almost in a contrived way, isn't it? People who don't like Bath say it's, you know, it's almost a contrived version of that Jane Austen England. It's been designed like that. It's not actually truly authentic, maybe.
Yeah, it is kind of like an England theme park.
Right.
It's like I moved to England world or something, you know. And racially it's very homogenous. And I just moved from an international school in Brunei, which is in Borneo, and which I loved. And there's all people from all over the world, from Nepal, Nigeria, Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong. And then I moved to Bath and it was just very, very white, very English. And it was more the shock of the homogeneity, really, and more of a monoculture that I found hard getting used to.
Did video games help smooth over any of those cracks, you know, having some Counter-Strike skills?
Yeah, they did. And the friends I made at school in Bath were into video games. And I remember there was a sort of controversy about whether to get the Xbox 360 or the PS3. And in lunch breaks, I'd play, me and a couple of guys would play Pro Evolution on a laptop in the study room. But it was like a cracked one where they had all the kits.
Nice.
So you had the best of both worlds. It was the superior gameplay of Pro Evolution, but you also had the kits.
Right.
And they might even have changed the names from like Manchester Red to back to Manchester United and from Gills back to Gigs and stuff like that. And so that was a golden
yeah,
age.
Yeah.
That was the perfect football game, I think, was the cracked, the hacked Pro Evo. So yeah, the video games definitely helped smooth that over and also provided an escape. I had no interest in like going out and trying to get served booze, which seemed to be the main aim of every 16-year-old mm-hmm. in this country, is to try and get served alcohol illegally. I was very bad at that, and so instead I'd stay at home and I'd play Fallout or Grand Theft Auto or Assassin's Creed, and it was all I sort of needed. That sounds sad now to say that out loud, but I still don't look back and go, oh, I wish I'd gone to more house parties during A-levels. I'm like, the first Assassin's Creed was sick, so I have no regrets.
Well, it seems like a good time to come to your second choice, which is from 2004. Can you tell us about the game?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. So this is one that I became obsessed with at my boarding school in Brunei before I moved over to the UK. It was my friend, my best friend, Mark, who we were sort of, we were very nerdy together. We were in physics class together. We shared a very similar sense of humor, that kind of nerdy sort of, I guess now you'd consider like a Reddit-y sort of XKCD style sort of science-y, physics-y humor. And he, one day I was staying over at his place for the weekend, and he said, you go, check out this game. And he opened it up, and it was Rome Total War. And I started playing it, and it was one of those experiences. You start playing it, and you play and play and play, and you go, oh, I should probably go get some water or something. It's probably been, what, half an hour? And you look at your watch, and it's been 5 hours.
Right, right.
You know? And it completely overtook me during GCSEs.
Uh-oh.
I'm still sort of astonished by it. I think I couldn't believe the amount of detail. I couldn't believe that you could have all these legions of soldiers, have them fight literally hundreds of other soldiers, and you could just pan the camera down, and you would watch individual soldiers have individual fights with other individual soldiers. Yeah, it was just astonishing. And to marry that with the turn-based sort of campaign map of you trying to expand your way across Europe is such a simple separation of the two gameplay modes, but it's still so evocative and engrossing. In both elements of the game, it gives you just the right amount of control without being overwhelming. So like the city management and the trade and stuff, you can't get to loads and loads of detail, but you can go into enough detail that's satisfying. And in the same way with the battles, you can make different formations, all this sort of thing, but the fundamental gameplay is relatively simple, and the soldiers do a lot of the hard work for you and all this kind of thing. It also spoke to just kind of a nerdiness I had about the ancient civilizations and Rome and Greece and stuff. Years before that, when I was younger, I got really into two games on the computer. I don't know if you remember these. One was called Pharaoh. I think made by the same people. Pharaoh and I think Rome 3. They're like SimCity, but for those ancient civilizations. And I was obsessed with that as well. But the combat in those was not good at all. Then I sort of shared it with other people. I had it on my laptop. I shared it with other people at the boarding house. And by the end of GCSEs, everyone had it on the laptops, and you'd be in the study when we're supposed to be studying for our exams, and you look over, and everyone would be playing Rome Total War on their laptops. So I think I probably ruined the prospects of a generation at that school with Rome.
Yeah, right. Did it have an adverse effect on your own exams, or did you get pie anyway?
I got all right. I did all right in the end. I did all right. Weirdly, history, I got one of the lower marks of my GCSEs, so it obviously doesn't help in that aspect.
Rome didn't come up.
It really didn't. If only, I would have crushed a question about the Testudo formation, but it didn't come up, unfortunately. And funnily enough, in sort of full circle way, so in 2021, I think, I was approached by Creative Assembly, who made Rome.
Mm. In Guildford, yeah.
That's the other aspect of it. It's an amazing British success story, right? And they were bringing out the remastered version of Rome, and they asked me to sort of front a travel program around Rome, ancient Roman Britain. And so I made this sort of short YouTube series with Creative Assembly about Roman Britain. We went to like York and all these old Roman fortresses and stuff.
Ah, so lovely.
That was such a dream come true to be able to like make something with Creative Assembly about a Rome Total War.
Yeah. Can you imagine telling 15, 16-year-old Phil Wang that you would one day do that? In playing away in the study room in Malaysia, one day you're going to tour some Roman sites of Britain with the developers of this game.
I know. I mean, especially considering I was playing a pirated copy. I think I even told them, soz, by the way, yeah. But you've still not seen a penny from me.
Take it off the fee.
Yeah, no, that was really sick. That was so cool. I think they even made a TV series with this technology, and like history channels have used the Creative Assembly engine to simulate battles and stuff. So yeah, they really achieved something.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So I think you've got the perfect name, Phil, really, for you. And you use it a lot to your advantage. A lot of your tours are named, you know, puns of Wang. But it sort of mixes, I don't know, it's just so English, Philip, isn't it?
Right, yeah.
And then so Chinese Wang. And it just, you talk about that a lot in your stand-up as well.
It's me, Phil Wang. Phil Wang, that's right, real name, Phil Wang. Phil, and then? Wang, Phil Wang. First you hear Phil, then you think, oh, everything's normal. And then bang, Wang. Phil by name, Wang by second name, Phil Wang. That's how names work.
When did you realise that it was a funny name and that you could use it to your advantage in that way? Did you have that sense at school?
I mean, not in Malaysia. Wang is the most common name in the world, I think. It's always between Wang Patel and Sanchez and Lee. But I think Wang is currently on top.
But juxtaposed with Phil is less common, right?
Well, of course. But in Malaysia, this is a completely normal kind of name to have. Lots of Chinese people have a sort of Western first name, but then their Chinese surname.
Sure.
It wasn't really until I moved to the UK. And first of all, people could not pronounce my name correctly, which is Wang. And I'd say, there's Wang. And the teacher at school would say, Phil, doing the roll call, Philip Wang, and I go, it's Wang. And they go, whatever.
Oh, jeez.
And eventually I just gave up. They didn't literally say whatever, but they said it with their eyes.
Right.
But eventually I gave up correcting people, and then I started doing stand-up, and Phil Wang was just such a memorable name for a comedian in the UK to have. It was kind of just punchy.
I remember reading, I read an interview with Clive James, the critic, and he said, because I think his original name was Vivian and he changed it to Clive, and he said having two single syllable first name, surname, it sounds like a door opening and slamming. I'm a bit jealous of two syllable full names.
Yeah, that's what I hear whenever I open and close the door. Clive James. But yeah, there's this sort of percussive kind of quality to Phil Wang. It's so much so that even like friends for years in comedy would say, oh, it's Phil Wang. When I turned up, they would never say hi, Phil. They'd say, hey, it's Phil Wang. And I realized that I could make something out of this, especially with Wang's sort of funny genital related definition in the UK, which I've lent into, because you got to, you know, yeah, you play to your strengths. And it wasn't really until my first Live at the Apollo that I really lent into it. And my strategy going in was just, make sure people remember your name. And so I came up with an opening routine about, my name's Wang, Phil Wang, Phil, Phil, Phil Wang, 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 and a bunch of jokes around there. First you hear Phil, then Wang, ba, 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 ba. And I've never really done the material like that since. Or I'd hardly done it like that before that Live at the Apollo performance. But it worked, and it really just sort of cemented in people's mind that my name was Phil Wang. I mean, I still get people from time to time saying, hey, Chris Lee, love your stuff. But most of the time people remember Phil Wang.
And then, I mean, your new tour, which starts 23rd of March, 62 shows around the UK, is called Wang In There, Baby. Did you have any other names on the cutting room floor for that pun-based names using Wang?
I've got a list on my computer I can share with you right now.
On your iPhone notes.
Yeah, totally.
Well, you shouldn't reveal this just in case you need to use some of them.
No, maybe I shouldn't. Well, hang on.
What are the rudest ones that you couldn't use for a tour, for a tour poster?
Well, one, yeah. one was Wangophilia, which doesn't, or the love of Wang.
Okay.
In brackets. Wang Fun. Wang Fun was probably the one, and I don't even know what that's a play on.
Right.
But Wang Fun was one that I thought was maybe too naughty. And Wang Time, which I might use because that's
Wang Time. Hang time. The kids say now, they'd say if they like a podcast or something, they say it's a good hang, don't they? So, but a good Wang sounds maybe
oh,
too,
do they?
Too rude.
A good Wang.
Oh dear. Okay. So, all right, let's come to your third game, which is from 2005. So I'm guessing you were in the UK at this point.
2005.
Not yet.
I'm still boarding. So I moved to the UK in 2006. Oh gosh, when did I play this? Maybe I did play this when I'd moved though. But it's Shadow of the Colossus. I ended up having, even when I was sort of in Malaysia without sort of video game magazines and stuff, there was a TV show we got on satellite TV called, there's a channel called Tech TV. It is an American channel that was centered around technology and stuff. And they had a show called Extended Play. It then became X Play. And it was basically a video games review show with very funny hosts and who really knew their stuff. And they would review all the new games, and they do big AAA games, and they do sort of more indie interesting games, and I found out about a lot of cool games that no one else really in Malaysia was looking for because they weren't watching the show. And I think Shadow of the Colossus came up on an episode of Extended Play, and I just thought it looked very interesting and very sort of mysterious, and I got it. And yeah, it's such a charming, unique, quite mysterious, strange game that it's one of those that I think about a lot.
So we should say in the game you go around and you have to take down these, is it 13, 12, around that number of giants, stone giants, don't you?
Yeah.
And you do it by crawling up their backs and, you know, plunging your sword into them and various other ways.
You're a small, young sort of boy, like, I don't know, like 14 or something, and you've got a horse, and there's this very large, very lonely world that you have to explore, and this mysterious voice. You're sort of headquartered in this temple, and this mysterious voice sort of tells you to go out and destroy these monsters to save the girl that you've brought with you. I'm not entirely sure, but I think it's meant to be a sequel to Ico. It follows on from the story where you save a young
girl.
It
certainly feels like it's in the same universe, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yes. So you've got this girl, and she's sort of unconscious, and the idea is that can only save her by taking down these giants. And so you sent off on these quests, and you just get on your horse and you try and make it to this giant's lair. And when you get there, you awake them, and they try and kill you, they try and destroy you, but you're so much smaller than them. They're basically like buildings to you. and you have to find the patches of them that are sort of mossy and grassy that you can hold on to, or the ledges of rock that you can grapple onto. You have to climb onto them, and you have to find their sensitive hit spots, and with your sword, you have to stab them, and you have to stab all the hit spots until you take them down.
It's kind of tragic as well when you do, don't you? There's definitely an element where you feel bad for doing so.
You do feel really bad because there's no sort of insinuation that these giants are evil or would ever have hurt you had you not come to their lair. And so when you do fell one, and it's so dramatic, they crash and tumble and fall. You do feel quite sad, and you feel kind of guilty that you've destroyed, because they're very beautiful as well, and they're so beautifully animated, and they're so alive, and their hair sort of wafts, and the fur wafts, and their eyes are very sort of evocative, and you feel very sad, which I think it was the first time I'd ever played a game that made you feel kind of guilty.
Yes.
For carrying out the objective.
Yeah, that's so true.
For killing something, right?
Yeah.
And it was very poetic. It was very beautiful, and you felt, the whole time you felt very small. It managed to make both you, the small protagonist, and them, the giant targets, both feel very vulnerable at the same time. And every time you defeated them, it always felt like it was just by the skin of your teeth that you managed to do it. And I think it told you so little about why you're doing these things and who these creatures were and where they'd come from, that even now, having played the game twice, it still has an air of mystery about it.
Yeah.
And a sense of scale, a real sense of scale. These things are really enormous. And there are a couple of real wow moments. There's a monster that flies through the air. And you have to get it, so when it lands, you have to grab onto it. And it try and get you off. It just flies into the air. Then you're just hurtling through the air. And you just have to hold onto a button to hold onto the fur. You can't even attack it. You just have to hold on until you get a little purchase. And that moment was just, that was magical. Yeah, it was really, really affecting.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
And it's still so unique. There's not really any other game like it.
No, yeah, the designer of those, Fumito Ueda, he's made three games, Ico, as you say, Shadow of the Colossus, and then The Last Guardian. And they stand apart from everything else, don't they? He's like a bit of an art school type tradition person rather than a tech science type person. Mm. And I think that comes across maybe in the way he directs as well, so... Yeah, great choice.
Yeah.
Amazing game. So we last met when I was working on a Guardian long read about Cambridge Footlights, which, for any listeners who haven't heard of it, you know, dozens of very well-known writers and performers have been through, perhaps most famously, the people behind Monty Python. When you get to Cambridge, what was it that made you want to join this? Because it didn't seem like you'd done... Had you done much sort of stage stuff at school? What took you down that path?
I'd done a couple of plays at school and stuff. I was mainly into music. I loved singing. I wanted to become a singer, really, when I was a teenager. But I'd always had this fascination with comedy, and I'd loved comedy, and I watched, you know, in Malaysia through satellite TV, watched The Simpsons and American sitcoms, but then also all the British classics, French and Saunders, Blackadder, Mr. Bean, you know, comedy. In a similar way to video games, felt like an escape, and it felt like this sort of other aspect of life and the world where real sort of honesty presided, and where things weren't so serious and couldn't hurt you, you know. And so I'd always had this fascination with comedy, and my mother, who had been to Cambridge, she was like in the second year of Women Allowed, and she'd always told me about the Cambridge Footlights and about all these great British comedians I was watching on TV had come through the Cambridge Footlights. And so I'd always known about them. And then when I moved to the UK, I'd seen stand-up on YouTube, and I was fascinated by this very pure, very instantaneous form of comedy of a person just getting on stage and talking and being funny and telling jokes. And my school put on a comedy night, and I asked to do 5 minutes. And I did 5 minutes of mainly stolen material that I sort of changed words to. I did like a bunch of Russell Peters jokes, but instead of Indian, I'd say Chinese, and I just mixed things around. And I thought comedy was kind of like karaoke, and you just kind of picked the songs you liked and you did your version of them. And although it wasn't completely original material, I got laughs, and I sort of was able to prove that I had the stage presence, and I was able to hold an audience's attention. And then the school put on another show in the bigger assembly hall. And I was like, oh gosh, here we go. This is the real big leagues now. And I wrote like a 10-minute set about the school, about teachers, about the other students. And it went down really good. So I've never done a set since, obviously. But that's the one that sort of kicked it all off. And then applying to university, Cambridge was great for engineering, which is what I wanted to do because my father was an engineer. But also there was this Footlights element, and I was getting into comedy in a big way, and I thought I'd really love to do Footlights and do comedy, and that's sort of how it played out. Really. Uh-huh. So I owe Cambridge a lot, and I owe the Footlights a lot for sure.
And that's where you met your fellow podcaster Pierre as well. Were you friends at uni?
Yeah. So he was a year below me, and I watched his first ever gig in Cambridge, and I went up to him and said that was great. I thought he was a PhD student because he's enormous and has a beard. And then he told me he was actually a year younger than me. And I thought he was having me on, but he wasn't. And so, yeah, we've known each other since then.
And then you become the president of the organization, the society. And then sort of what power did you have with that role?
Not much, to be honest. Yeah. It was very sort of egalitarian. Society, mainly I just had a lot of emails to reply to. That's the main thing. And there's a lot of admin roles. Right. I had to like arrange meetings and, you know, book rooms.
Okay.
And it wasn't as glamorous as I'd expected it to be.
The opposite of power.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was just responsibility. Yeah. They say with great power comes with great responsibility. And mine was just responsibility. I didn't even have the great power. I only got half of the Spider-Man deal.
Okay. Let's come to your fourth game, which is from 2013. This is a game about admin, interestingly. Can you tell us about it?
Yes. Yeah, this is Papers, Please. It's a game by Lucas Pope, who he's also made the Return of the Obra Dinn, which I keep meaning to play, but I haven't played
yet.
Oh,
it's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's supposed to be wonderful. Papers, Please, I heard about. And I was really attracted by the audacity of making an admin game, of making a game where you just had to check people's documents at sort of immigration control. And I thought, sure, how fun can this be? I downloaded it and I started playing. And what's amazing about Papers, Please is that it really does start out as you just stamping documents, checking someone's details line up with what they say they are. And if they are, you trump them through and they come through. If they aren't, then they're rejected and they have to return back to the line they came from. And at first you go, okay, this seems pretty simple. And the decisions are pretty easy. This guy's obviously not who he says he is. This lady is, he can come in. But then it starts to then sort of sneak in some really difficult choices. Sympathetic characters who don't have the documents they need. So you let them in and potentially put yourself in trouble, or do you reject them and live with the guilt of that? And then so there's some criminal elements come in and start trying to bribe you. And at first you go, no, I'm clean. I'm doing this for the good of Azkaban or whatever the
fictional
country is. But then because you're also having to make sure you get enough pay to pay for your rent and food and like
your
son's birthday is coming up and can you get him a present? And so suddenly you start to really think about the consequences of your actions and you realize, oh, I actually do need some more money. Maybe I can let this criminal through or get a bit of money, then I'm safe for a bit. And the way that the game is able to sneak these difficult decisions on you is really amazing. And the amount of detail, and again, the beauty is all like 8-bit style, but it's very beautiful and there's just the right amount of detail. And just little things like, you know, the imagery of the long sort of queue of dark shadows moving towards your office, and then one figure will break off and come into your office, and then they'll become a fully formed person with a face and a story. And then once they leave your office, they become a sort of this dark shadow again that moves away, and you know, their life is no longer in your control. It's just a very beautiful and poetic way of going about it, and such a simple setting can become so rich. And I'm sure I could go through it again now and discover whole new playthroughs and new endings and all these little secrets that passed me by the first time. It's so amazing to make a game that so small, that rich.
Yeah, and a game which is about something as well, isn't it? You know, the temptation to become corrupt. It just shows how, you know, that inch by inch that can just creep into a person's life with that sort of who has that, you know, that degree of power, but not too much, but you can just see, and then how the system starts to unravel as a result.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's a very powerful piece of social commentary, really.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So you were, I mentioned in the introduction, you were a contestant in Taskmaster, which obviously has a big following among players of board games and video games. And one of the tasks that you were given was to recreate a video game in live action, which is just one of the most memorable, I think, tasks Taskmaster's ever done. You picked GoldenEye, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to settle on that game when you were in the moment, that panicked moment of thinking, what am I going to do?
It's such a panic moment. It really is a blur when you read that that task, and then you have like 5 minutes, and you go, oh God, which one to pick? I felt actually by being a gamer, I was in at a disadvantage because I had too many to pick from.
Right, right, yeah.
I thought about, I mean, James did an amazing job with Grand Theft Auto. That's one I thought would be too difficult, but he managed to do it. I don't know. I mean, the team managed to do it in an amazing way.
It was his jumping, wasn't it? Really helped, I think.
It was the jumping. His impression of like a GTA jump is perfect. I don't know how he even got his legs up in that direction. Well, yeah, it was really perfect.
You weren't tempted to do Rome Total War then?
Yeah. Yeah, just me and Alex and doing a testudo and trying to scale the walls and but I mean, I think the idea was go for something classic, you know, really go for the nostalgia aspect here, and GoldenEye has this real nostalgic quality to it, and also it felt like something that visually you could achieve, you know, there are those real visual markers of those early first-person shooters, of the gun being in the middle of the person's chest, and you're sticking down the middle of the camera, and the movements of the characters, and then trying to turn around to aim and everything, you know.
And the slapping. Did you do the slapping? I think.
Oh yeah, the missed hand-to-hand combat of just like chopping the hair. yeah. Yeah. So it felt like something that was sort of begging to be done in that scenario. But yeah, the whole segment came out great, and Greg was so thrilled with it. He gave everyone points. Yeah, so that was a magical moment.
Yeah, I liked when you first played, because they gave you the task in a sort of Atari 2600 version of a video game, didn't you? It was really cute.
Yeah, the amount of work those guys do. They made an actual 8-bit whatever game to introduce the task.
I remember when you walked into the room and saw it, you had a reaction, and Greg said, "Ah, the cry of the nerd," which has now become like a classic thing that I see that on the internet a lot now.
Oh, really? Well, the cry of the nerd.
It's very funny.
I was just so impressed. Yeah. Apparently, they put like an Easter egg in that game. Apparently, like you found the one part of the map or the Taskmaster house map that was like a little secret or something. Yeah, those guys put a lot of work into that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, video games seem quite hard to do on TV. I mean, there's very few shows. There's Games Master, obviously, and then Dara did Go 8-Bit for a little while. But it seems like they should be easier. How do you think? Do you think it's possible to do a good video game show on British TV? Or is it just two worlds colliding?
I think it's very hard. I filmed a pilot for a video game show once. Sort of like a video game Top Gear was the idea, like three presenters talking about games and like all these game nerds huddled around and watching and stuff. Yeah, I wonder why it doesn't work. I think part of it is that the market is cornered by the internet, by Twitch and YouTube, which I think are formats that just, delivery systems that just make more sense for video games.
Yeah.
Because video games are quite a private experience to share that in such a public way on TV feels a bit odd. Maybe this is just my experience. Yeah. But I think what's nice about Twitch and YouTube is that these are also private experiences. And so the intimacy of video gaming is preserved in a way. Whereas when you see a TV show with all these people and sort of celebrities talking about video games, that you've lost that sense of intimacy with the game.
In the video game Top Gear, which Top Gear presenter were you then? Were you the Jeremy Clarkson character?
I was definitely the Clarkson of the group. I was definitely the sort of the alpha gamer. But yeah, my Jeremy Clarkson, of course, now has a Harvest Moon farm. Which has proven very popular as well.
That sounds brilliant. I'd watch Phil Wang's Farmville. I think that could work. Okay, let's. Why don't we come to your fifth and your final game? Can you tell us about it?
So my final game, this is, I guess, the most recent one, is God of War, the reboot, the remake.
Oh.
When Kratos goes to sort of Scandinavia, sort of Northlands, it becomes about North mythology. I love the God of War franchise. I played every single one. That first one was astonishing. The first boss battle in the first game where you're fighting the Hydra. And they managed to make a quick time event feel like you do have agency and that you do have to get it right. And when you finish the quick time event, Kratos and his blades of blades on the chains, that you pull this Hydra's head down and you skewer it on the mast of the ship. I was astonished by that. It was so like violent and so vivid and so imaginative. And of course, I was nervous about the remake because it was going down such a different path tonally. It's becoming a lot more grown up and filmic. And I think there was a worry like, have they been off more than they chew? Is this a bit pretentious now? You know, like gritty Kratos, like sad Kratos. Can that be done? He's such a sort of silly character, really.
Yes.
Such an arcadey character. Can you make him serious?
Yeah, he's like a Greek myth. He's like a character from Greek myth, isn't he? Sort of really primary colours, I suppose.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And then now suddenly you can see sort of the pockmarks on his cheek and the detail and the dust on his head. And I started God of War, the remake, and it's just the most beautiful, engrossing experience with his son that you have to look after, but also who looks after you. And the whole game is in one take, so there's no cut. The camera never cuts. It only ever moves from Kratos's back and moves around. And I was like, why? Why would you even give yourself that challenge?
What? It's like the Spice Girls video for Wannabe. They did that as well, didn't they? But there's a much shorter amount of time.
Was that one shot?
Yeah. That was the inspiration.
Yeah. But what I really like is, and this speaks to my love of the storytelling in games and how I feel like the storytelling for me is the main purpose of these video games, and how video games are the ultimate form of storytelling is that it's able to tell this epic tale, this epic story so vividly and so engrossingly, and make you really care about this character, and make you care about a character you already knew and thought was kind of silly, and reimagine him in a completely new way and still sympathize with him and care about him and care about his son and care about his story with his wife that you never, his newer wife that you never meet in the other games, and you only hear about. And she takes on this sort of mythical kind of Athena-like presence in the journey. And I like that it's part of this movement. I think sort of The Last of Us is also part of a very similar movement of story-heavy, exploration-heavy, relationship-heavy, character-driven video game storytelling that I really, really love. And I'd always hoped video games would move in this direction, and I'm so glad that they have. And again, I love like myths and Greek myths and Norse myths and everything, and I love games that lean into that stuff and really sort of revel in it. And the way that, like in the original God of War, the way that you kill Poseidon, you kill Hermes, and you rip the Zeus to shreds and stuff, it's just so sick. I think that's what it comes down to. I'm trying to be all florid about these things, but what it comes down to is it's just sick, isn't it? and then the axe, the amazing, that's such a beautiful piece of game design, is the axe in God of War that you can throw and retrieve. That thunk feeling when it lands in your hand and the way it whizzes around, and there's real speed to it and it really makes the best of the haptic feedback in a controller. You really feel like this thing's like falling, smashing back into your hand and stuff. Yeah, it's just sick. That's all I can say about it, Simon. It's sick.
I think people could be a bit snooty about video games, obviously, but, it really does get to something that's there in, the Iliad and the Odyssey, which are, they do really, like, revel in the violence of it, and it's sort of sick as well, in the original Greek. So, yeah, it is getting to something authentic, just using our current dominant medium, perhaps.
Oh, yeah, no, I read the Iliad and the Odyssey and stuff, and... yeah, it's brutal. It's really like guts being rendered and heads being smashed against walls and stuff. And people like to go, oh, we live in such violent times. Now that sort of this fascination with violence is a modern thing. It really isn't. It's as old as we are. And I love that these games really sort of play into the gross, the violence, and the visceral appeal of these old myths. Yeah, I love it.
There we go. Phil Wang, pro-violence.
You heard it here first.
Okay, let's go through your console. So we've got Ski Free, Rome Total War, Shadow of the Colossus, Papers, Please, and God of War. That's an eclectic bunch. Really nice. Very good console there.
Yeah, I think it's a good spread.
Yeah, very good spread. Have you got a... We need to come up with a name to market this to the world. Have you got a name for your console that we can use?
Well, Wang has to be in there. I'm not the first to this, of course, because Wang Computers from the 80s kind of beat me to the punch, but...
You have to buy the name back off them.
Yeah, maybe I could call this Wang Computers 2. Well, Wang Cube. Wang Cube.
Nice.
Wang Cube.
Wang Cube.
It's time a cube came back onto the console environment.
It is.
Yeah, the Wang Cube.
I can see it now. Wang Cube. Yeah, very... okay, right. I've just got one last question for you, Phil. Thank you for this. It's been wonderful. So I saw you at the Edinburgh Festival last year, and you had a bit like in your show where you were talking about how British people have this weird fear of like reheating rice.
Oh yeah,
which isn't a thing in Asia. And in the particular show I was at, I think there was like a guy in the audience who had maybe seen you doing it earlier in the week. And so he brought with him a pack of rice that he threw onto the stage at you because it said on the label, do not reheat or something like that.
Do not reheat. Yeah.
And it was such a funny moment. And you said at the time, after that interaction had finished, you said, that's going to be, just so you know, that's going to be the highlight of the show for you all, by the way. And
it was. I was true to my word.
It was only in the sense that it's just so memorable because as an audience member, you feel like it's a one-off thing
totally.
That only like, oh, okay, you did that show every night that week, but I was in the audience when that amazing individual thing happened that probably wasn't repeated. So I just wonder that, you know, to sort of when you've got this tour coming up, are you looking for those moments, you know, to give the audience each show where it's just a one-off thing so they feel special? Or is it always just that they come up when they come up?
Well, that's the thing about those moments is you can't make them happen.
Right.
they just happen, right? And as a comedian, you just try and get better and better at dealing with them when they happen and getting as many laughs out of it as you can. And so I'm not going to sit here and encourage people to pelt me with rice across the country. I mean, the terrible optics, at the very least. but if you are, yeah, but I try and be ready for any any occasion. No matter what staple is thrown at me, I try and be ready for it.
Wise words.
Yes, bring your pastas, bring your breads. I'm ready for it all.
Okay, well, Phil, thank you so much for your time and for your choices and for sharing your story with us. I really appreciate it. It's been great.
Thanks, Simon. Really appreciate it. Love the podcast, and it's an honour to be on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Phil. It's Phil Wang, everyone, or perhaps it should be Phil Wong. Phil, I'm so sorry about your jerk of a teacher, but fair play for you working that to your advantage in the years since. Phil, what a great guest Phil was. I think stand-up comedy's gain is video game criticism's loss. He just was able to speak so intelligently, so literally about his choices. I just absolutely loved it, particularly, I think, hearing his thoughts on Shadow of the Colossus. Just wonderful, really such an intelligent way to describe the appeal of that game. Phil is, I think, one of our best stand-up comics working today in the UK. You can, of course, hear him on his own podcast that he runs with the fantastic Pierre Novelli, who I will also at some point be begging to come on this podcast. The two of them make for a formidable double act, I would say. But also you can see Phil, who is touring the UK. He begins his tour on the 23rd of March, and in fact he will be touring all the way through till the end of November. More than 62 shows at theatres all around the country. I urge you to go and see him. He is really one of the best in the business, I think. Really, just very, very precise comedy that I enjoy very much. But not overworked or anything like that. I'm not a comedy critic, so I don't quite have the language for that. But I really like it anyway. You might too. You can buy tickets at philwang.co.uk. Please go and do that. You can write to me at myperfectconsole at gmail.com. Thank you to those of you who have done so and continue to do so. I had an email this week from a listener who was requesting that I put the five games that the guest chooses into the actual description of the podcast. They were saying that they don't always know the games that have been chosen and they'd like to go and look them up. That's absolutely fair enough. But I think there's part of me that quite enjoys the fact that you have to listen to find out what those choices are. I'm sure there are some people who enjoy those being revealed to them in real time. So as a sort of compromise, if you go to the My Perfect Console Twitter account, that's My Perfect Console with the O's removed from console, then every Thursday I will put up the five games that the guest that week has picked, so that if you want to go and chase them, you can hunt those down. If you want to support the podcast financially, then please go to Acast Plus. For just £3 a month, you can become an early access supporter. You will get ad-free episodes 24 hours before the general public. A little bonus for you, but really, it would just be helpful to, you know, if you want to support the podcast in that way, then that's good. It's awkward having to ask these things, but, you know, this is the world we live in. You can follow me at Simon Parkin on Twitter, and you can also read some of the journalism I've done and some of the books I've written at my website, simonparkin.com. Okay, only remains for me to say thank you for listening. I will be back next week with one new guest, their five games, and one more perfect console. Till then, have a great week. Goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, where are you, the police?
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.